Greetings, warriors, veterans, and American loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-ah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. On January 17, 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower said, quote, "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist," end quote. Okay. There are about 900 active duty generals and admirals, called flag officers, today for our 1.3 million troops. This is a ratio of one flag officer for every 1,400 troops. During World War II, an admittedly different era, there were over 2,000 flag officers for a little over 12 million active troops. That's one for every 6,000. So we got about four times the number now. I suspect that many of those officers retire into the defense industry, further inflating the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about. This year's proposed budget for the Pentagon and nuclear weapons work at the Department of Energy is $886 billion, over twice as much, adjusted for inflation, as at the time of Eisenhower's speech. The Pentagon now consumes over half the federal discretionary budget, leaving priorities like public health, job training, and education to compete for what remains. In 2020, Lockheed Martin received $75 billion in Pentagon contracts, more than the entire budget for the State Department and the Agency for International Development combined. This can't be good. And the deeply entrenched administrative state resisted everything President Trump tried to do and will continue to unless we elect someone who will stop it. You know, Tsar Nicholas II said, quote, "I do not rule Russia. 10,000 clerks do." Soon he was dead. The communists would take over. May our path be different. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. What have you been up to, Skip?
Well, Colonel, I've just been savoring the final vestiges of the fleeting days of summertime. I do my swimming and canning tomatoes and just all kinds of summer stuff. We're getting ready to do peach jam now. So this is a time of harvest, and we're getting ready for the snow to fly up here in the great white north.
You mean that winter thing is coming?
I know. I wish we could have like 70 degrees every single day. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, it could go down to like 60 a couple times. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You are a very tolerant man.
Okay, here's what we have for you today. On News and Comments by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss Beijing's failing economy. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Next, former Navy SEAL Tim Sheeby now fights fires in Montana and plans to keep serving our nation. Then Air Force vet Ron Kraft will talk about towing a jet fighter to safety. Peter Klein will share about boots to books. And our football co-host will join us to talk about what our Service Academy football season will look like, in his opinion.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We do welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or by Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel. Of course, we'll start with the news. Take us there, Skip.
Well, Colonel, the federal government agency tasked with leading the response to natural disasters has its hands full, as over 1,000 Americans remain missing following wildfires that devastated the Hawaiian island of Maui. FEMA, nonetheless, is mandating a three-hour diversity training for employees that argues, among other things, that white supremacy is ingrained in nearly every system and institution in the United States. Have fun with this, Colonel.
And if this federal agency is forcing this BS on all the people, to include the volunteers who want to help in Hawaii, clearly is being forced on all our military people too, despite the denials by some of the military brass. And it sure wasn't part of the Army I served in for 22 years. How about the Marine Corps you served in, Skip?
No, we were a little more, you know, no nonsense. We focused on fighting wars and things like that.
Weird. Okay.
China's military is developing weapons to disrupt brain functions and influence government leaders or entire populations, according to U.S. and Singaporean intelligence analysts. Quote, "The weapons can be used to directly attack or control brains using microwave or other directed energy weapons in handheld guns or larger weapons firing electromagnetic beams," their paper details. Labeled neurostrike weapons, these sorts of weapon systems are engineered literally to target the brains of military personnel using non-kinetic technology. The goal is to impair thinking, reduce situational awareness, inflict long-term neurological damage, and cloud normal cognitive functions.
Look at all the places in our nation that are working with China on projects. Most of our universities are, many local governments and businesses are. It's clearly time to break away from our real enemy, China.
Our Air Force Academy is again mandating what is being called radical leftist gender training, as some parents of Air Force Academy cadets are calling it. One parent noted that the Academy just began briefings for the new juniors called sex education. They're told they can't take pictures or videos or record anything. There are enlisted airmen walking through the group to ensure no phones are seen. They were told that sex is determined at birth, but gender is how we see ourselves. They were all told that as upcoming officers, they are going to be expected to respect those who report to them, including their gender choices. There is currently a calculus teacher, a male, who wears female Air Force uniforms to class. This makes many of the cadets very uncomfortable. Thank God it makes somebody uncomfortable.
This is clearly indoctrination of a leftist idea, and they know it's void of all logic. That's why the cadets can't record it. Our military is having trouble getting people to join, and this nonsense will certainly drive away anyone with traditional American values, including Judeo-Christian values. This is crazy.
And speaking of our Air Force Academy, the football team just revealed its new uniforms, which feature a tribute to the Doolittle raid on Japan, which occurred immediately after the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. All of the planes were lost, many of the crews killed or captured, and many, including Colonel Doolittle, made it back to the U.S. Leftists have gone on the attack against this honoring of this incredibly brave action in World War II.
I fully support the Air Force Academy for honoring the Doolittle raid and their crew members. There is no logic to opposing responding to an unwarranted attack with an attack. Go Air Force!
And after years of neglecting electronic warfare, our Army is rushing to revitalize its jamming capabilities. The catalyst is the Ukraine war, where cheap but plentiful drones are playing a vital, almost decisive role, doing everything from spotting for artillery to destroying armored vehicles. At the same time, jamming has emerged as perhaps the most effective counter-drone weapon. Ukraine may be losing 10,000 drones a month, many to Russian electronic warfare systems, while it strives to boost its jamming capabilities. Rather than using expensive anti-aircraft missiles and guns to shoot down a drone that may cost only a few $100s, it's easier to disrupt the link between the drone and its operator, causing it to crash. This has put fresh impetus behind our Army's electronic warfare upgrades. Indeed, the Pentagon says that our Army was fundamentally reinvesting in rebuilding our tactical electronic warfare capability after that largely left the force over the last 20 years.
Wow, losing 10,000 drones a month? I'm glad we're paying attention and are upgrading our electronic warfare systems. That's good.
And the attacks range from the exotic, poisoned by drinking polonium-laced tea or touching a deadly nerve agent, to the more mundane of getting shot at close range. Some take a fatal plunge from an open window. Over the years, Kremlin political critics, turncoat spies, and investigative journalists have been killed or assaulted in a variety of ways. None has been known to perish in an air accident, until the private plane carrying a mercenary chief who staged a brief rebellion in Russia plummeted into a field from tens of thousands of feet after breaking apart. Assassination attempts against foes of President Vladimir Putin have been common during his nearly quarter century in power. Those close to the victims and the few survivors have blamed Russian authorities, but the Kremlin has routinely denied involvement, as it did, saying it was, quote, a complete lie, unquote. It had anything to do with the jet crash. There also have been reports of prominent Russian executives dying under mysterious circumstances, including falling from windows, although whether they were deliberate killings or suicides is sometimes difficult to determine.
This isn't too surprising if you're aware of how things work in Russia. But this has even occasionally happened here, too. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing. We can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in getting involved in getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check CVAFrontlines.com. That's CVAFrontlines.com. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up on Frontlines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll talk with former Navy SEAL Tim Sheeby. At ease, troops, take a break.
Fresh, flash, frozen from the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com, hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coria with your home defense tip of the week. Next time you upgrade to a new cell phone, don't throw your old one away. If your old phone can hold a charge, you can stage this phone for emergency use in a home defense situation. Every cell phone, whether on contract or not, has the ability to call 911. Keep an old phone in the glove box of your car as well as your safe room just in case. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum. It's 20 minutes after the hour, and you are in formation and listening to the Frontlines of Freedom all across America. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. China remains our nation's worst enemy, has the world's second largest economy, and is in a world of trouble. It's the economy, the engine of China's past economic growth, has stalled while today's unique economic circumstances limit Beijing's options. Its economic rise has been dependent on one, real estate and infrastructure, and two, manufacturing. The latter also relies on exports and foreign demand for Chinese goods, and both have been buoyed by over a decade of inflowing foreign capital investments. A third factor, domestic consumption and services, is one that Beijing has been pushing. The regime understood that building, construction, and even manufacturing would eventually all dry up, and that its domestic engine would need to be strong enough to carry the economy. That day has come, and the domestic consumption has seized up, putting the economy and the regime in jeopardy. Real estate is over a quarter of China's economy. Aside from its importance as an economic engine, it also makes up a significant portion of the Chinese people's wealth, the other being the stock market, which has also been tanking. This is especially true for the middle class, a big part of the urban population. The bottom has fallen out of their real estate market. The result is that developers are losing money, defaulting on their debt, and hurting both foreign and domestic investors. A vehicle to juice economic growth in the past has been infrastructure development. This spurs the economy. Years of central bank stimulus encouraged waves of infrastructure development, roads, airports, bridges, power infrastructure. This provided jobs, grew the economy, both locally and nationally, and kept the stream of kickbacks flowing to local officials. Local governments took huge loans to pay for these expensive and at times wasteful infrastructure projects, even though there was never any real demand for the services. Ponzi schemes work until they don't. The CCP has dabbled in cleaning up debts associated with rampant real estate and infrastructure building. Using new debt to repay old debt is a time-honored tradition. It's also utilized by our government and works as long as new investors believe and trust the institution running the scheme. Today's liquidity picture is both different and worse. There's a perfect storm of issues presently causing both foreign investors and Chinese nationals to exit China. Controls play a part in stopping money from leaving, but that didn't stop almost 11,000 Chinese millionaires from leaving the country in 2022. As for foreign investments, then-President Trump is credited with the idea of decoupling from China and reinvesting in America. He highlighted the many ills of our economy so intertwined with China's. But without a cataclysmic event, few businesses heeded that warning. Well, the event came as the COVID-19 pandemic. Western businesses saw the logistical and supply chain problems created by Beijing's draconian COVID lockdowns. China was the world's factory, but was also the world's economy's single point of failure. Businesses began to move manufacturing away from China. For years, China's cheap labor, including forced labor from re-education camps that employed victims such as the Falun Gong practitioners, produced inexpensive exports to which Western consumers and businesses turned a blind eye. Today, disgust with China's abysmal human rights record made many Western companies turn away. Western nations, after two decades of near zero interest rates coinciding with Chinese economic rise, began to tighten monetary policy and battle impending economic recession. This takes us to today. Economic downturns in the U.S. and Europe have sapped the demand for Chinese goods, slowing down Chinese exports and manufacturing. In the past 18 months, our Federal Reserve and the central banks of most developed nations have worked together to increase interest rates at the fastest pace in a century. So global investment dollars are flowing to the U.S. and away from China. This further limits Beijing's options to save its economy. Indeed, the yuan is trading at its lowest level since 2007. Okay, the traditional drivers of China's economic growth are disappearing. China is facing major demographic issues internally. Its rapidly aging population and the lack of widespread pensions are both an economic and political risk. Today, it faces the highest youth unemployment in recent history, and the wealth built up by its middle-aged middle class is being eroded by crumbling real estate and stock markets. And China reported its first official population decline in 2022. An aging population combined with falling fertility rates, despite loosening their one-child policy, affects population growth. China expert Gordon Chang believes China could lose up to two-thirds of its population by 2100. And China has been pushing its economically regressive, state-centric, and authoritarian political and economic system. China's once high-flying technology sector has been cut in size at a time when the country needs it the most. Small businesses lack the confidence or the capital to invest and grow. And this is linked to our regional banking crisis. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March cut off a major funding source for Chinese startups. And recent political and economic pushbacks against the U.S. venture capital investing in China has suddenly turned off a major spigot of Chinese funding. Thus, domestic Chinese growth and consumption are nowhere near the level needed to save the country from economic ruin. Deflation, failing exports, slower stock market activity, declining property prices, and the crashing stock market are all recent symptoms. Chinese authorities will likely turn to the usual playbook of easing financial policies, cutting bank reserve requirements, lowering housing regulations, and increasing borrowing limits. They might print money and begin direct payments to consumers, similar to what our government did during the height of the pandemic. But China's economy is too large and too concentrated to save by making marginal changes. Their authorities continue to hold the official line of a 5% GDP growth for 2023, hoping to attract outside capital. Beijing also recently met with President Biden's climate delegation, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and others to drum up investments, but it's all likely too little, too late. In reality, it's hard to forecast when this crisis will come. The regime hasn't faced a real political crisis since 1989. How much control, power, and influence does the CCP hold over the Chinese people today? What we do know is that the CCP, in its death throes, could be extremely dangerous and unpredictable. And they are our enemy. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Front Lines of Freedom. And now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have to share this week, Roland?
Well, there was a pretty exciting rescue this month of four scuba divers off the coast of South Carolina. The four divers ranged in age from 16 to 64, and they'd been scuba diving and spearfishing about 63 miles east of Myrtle Beach on August 13th. The current in the seas were pretty strong, and that caused the divers to resurface far from their boat. The boat driver reported the divers missing about 2 p.m. that day, and that's when Coast Guard units began their search. You know, finding divers in the water is difficult in any condition, and searches for them are often unsuccessful because they wear dark wetsuits and the only visible part of their bodies are their heads, which is about the size of a basketball. Now, to make things even more difficult, by the time a Coast Guard 130 was able to get out there, it was pitch black dark. But thanks to night vision goggles of the Coast Guard and a flashlight from the divers, the aircraft spotted them at 12:45 in the morning. They dropped a life raft to the divers and diverted a Navy ship, which was close by, to pick them up. What a great joint rescue for the Coast Guard and the Navy. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll meet with former Navy SEAL Tim Sheeby. Then we'll talk with Ron Kraft about towing an aircraft in flight. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for some boxing. Box three rounds, take a break, box another three, then stand at ease.
As veterans, we at Concerned Veterans for America know defending freedom comes at a high cost. Our lawmakers should consider that cost when they send troops to war.
If wars don't serve our national interest, our brave men and women shouldn't be deployed into harm's way. Our troops should not be in combat because Congress doesn't want to make tough decisions about military engagement.
Find out how you can join the movement to end our nation's endless wars at cvafrontlines.com. That's cvafrontlines.com.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome Navy veteran, indeed a former SEAL, Tim Sheeley. Tim is a veteran, a current small business owner, a father, a husband, a conservative, patriotic American who lives in Montana. It's really clear he loves America. Tim, do I say welcome to you, or am I supposed to say welcome aboard? You sailors have different languages than we Army guys.
Welcome aboard would be more appropriate.
Okay, consider yourself welcome aboard, Tim.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
Tim, start by telling us about your time in uniform. When and why did you decide to join the Navy? Did you go directly into the SEALs? How did you get in? Why did you get in?
I wanted to be in the military from, you know, a very young age. I'm not sure why, to be totally honest, but the first time I ever remember really having the desire to put the uniform on was I was born in 1985. I'm 37 today. But I remember watching, I was on the floor of our house in 1990, 1991. And I remember seeing the video, you know, as they call it, the first TV war was the Gulf War, Desert Storm. And I remembered seeing a video, which is fairly famous now, I think, of a night vision video of an American soldier, you know, IMTing through the desert in live fire there in Desert Storm. And I remember seeing that image as a five-year-old kid and saying, wow, that's really impressive and brave, you know, to actually see this for real. It's not a movie. This isn't fake. It's not an actor. You know, that's an American fighting in a faraway land for our interests and for our freedoms. And, you know, it's hard to put a finger on it when you're that age, but all I saw, all I felt was that's impressive. I respect that. And I want to be somebody who's out there putting myself on the line to protect others. And at that moment, really after that, I was always running around in camouflage gear, toy guns in the woods. You know, it was just that, well, that's what I was going to be, was, you know, as I called them back then, an Army guy. I was going to grow up and be an Army guy. Eventually, I learned my neighbor, who was a great mentor and friend of mine, Harry Tebow. He was a Navy pilot during the Korean War. And I grew up near a lake in Minnesota, and he'd land his Piper Cub on the lake in the wintertime. And he took me up flying one time when I was eight. And I just fell in love with aviation immediately. I said, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I love this. And at that point, I decided I wanted to go into the Navy and be a Navy pilot. And of course, like all kids in that era, you know, started watching Top Gun and, you know, on repeat and on loops and all the other old movies. And I got my pilot's license and sold an airplane before I had my driver's license. And that became my obsession, was joining the Navy, going to the Naval Academy and becoming a naval aviator. Obviously, what changed in that time was 9/11 happened. And when I got to the academy, which was in 2004, I realized that I wanted to be a naval aviator. I wanted to, you know, someday be an astronaut. That's what I wanted. But as I was there and as we were seeing more and more of both the Iraq and Afghan war unfold, it was very clear that's not what the country needed and that's not what the country was hurting for. They weren't hurting for more fighter pilots. What they needed was leaders on the ground. And I'll never forget an all-hands meeting we had as young midshipmen there in 2005. And, you know, obviously the Afghan war was in a bit of a stalemate. And of course, Iraq was at its peak of the insurgency beginning. And we had an all-hands and the message was pretty simple, which was, listen, we're taking a lot of casualties. We've had more Naval Academy graduates killed in combat here in the last couple of years than we've had since Vietnam. And frankly, there's going to have to be more of you going into the ground services, i.e. the Marine Corps. And we were seeing service warfare officers even being taken off ships, being given desert camis and a rifle and sent to Iraq and Afghanistan. So there was a bit of a call to serve even within the service to say, all right, there's something I want to do. I want to fly jets, but that's a selfish desire on me. The country's not asking for more Mavericks. They're asking for more, you know, Sergeant Yorks. And for me at that point, that coupled with my experience at the academy, nothing against naval aviators, great guys, but you know, I'd met a couple of SEALs at the academy. There's very few SEALs, of course, especially you know, at that day and age when we're all deployed. And just the caliber of those gentlemen and their leadership, their background, interacting with them, seeing them around the academy was an incredibly impactful experience for me. And I made the decision pretty quick that, you know, I was going to try to go into the special operations community. And that's how I decided to start pursuing my desire to become a SEAL. And during that time, a bit of an interesting off-road story, but it would be interesting to you. I was allowed to participate, and it actually was the first one to do, you know, the Army Special Operations Exchange Program, where I went through airborne school, ranger school, recon school as a midshipman at the Naval Academy, graduated ranger school, got my ranger tab and airborne Army Reconnaissance Surveillance Leaders course, and did ranger indoctrination program with the ranger regiment. So I was able to immerse myself in the Army Special Operations community, which was incredibly important for me for years to come. And how that came about was early in the war, as a lot of folks in the special operations community are well aware, those outside of it may not realize this, but the global war on terrorism was the first time when we had really sustained operations where SEALs, Air Force Special Operations, Green Berets, Rangers, you know, the special mission units were all working together almost every single day and night on the battlefield under combined command structures. And they were having to go on joint missions together. And these are groups, especially when you talk about the SEAL teams, that had not worked really together almost ever. And then the last time they really had kind of worked together was Vietnam, you know, your era. So all that institutional knowledge had faded away. And what you had was literally different languages. You know, SEALs called each other boat crews, which made no sense to the Army. They called each other squads. You know, how we did tactics, how, what weapons we used, what uniforms we wore. SEALs would always wear black because they're always coming out of the water at night. And of course, you know, the Army was wearing camouflage. The way the radio systems we used, the frequencies we used, everything was different. So if you just plopped in a SEAL team with a Ranger platoon or a Green Beret team or a special mission unit team, there was some very serious compatibility issues that made it harder for them to work together. And we saw those things cause major problems at Robert's Ridge during, you know, the Lone Survivor, Operation Red Wing. I mean, there were so many different missions that frankly went awry. And although it wasn't the sole factor, the contributing factor in a lot of those was the challenge of integrating, you know, a naval commando unit that's made to work under, on, and around the water in groups of 4, 6, 8, 10 people with an Army unit that is fundamentally a land warfare light infantry group that's operating in 30 to 40 man elements on the land. And as that came to a head in, you know, 04, 05, and 06, two gentlemen, both senior officers, one in the Army, the Special Forces community, and one SEAL, were going to NDU together in DC, National Defense University. And they said, hey, we should try to do something about this. And of course, the Army's never going to adapt to the Navy in the SOCOM world. I mean, one thing, again, a lot of people don't realize is as a SEAL, you always work for the Army. At some point, you're answering to an Army, maybe a major, lieutenant colonel, a colonel or general, but at some point in your chain of command as a Navy SEAL, you are going to be answering to the Army, at least during the global war on terror for those 20 years.
That's a really interesting point. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with former Navy SEAL Tim Sheely. Tim, talk about that, how they learn to work together, because that's all the services like to pick on each other. And all of us have different languages, and we had to learn. And I guess really, really, especially at the special ops level, not just how to work together, but how to work hand in hand. Am I right?
Yep, exactly. So, but yeah, back to your question, and I know we're getting long-winded on this topic, but you know, given your background and the audience, I think they'd be interested in this. But you're right. I mean, working together jointly became a very unique element of this global war on terror. Because when you look at previous conflicts, yeah, there was always some jointness, but usually, you know, World War II, the Navy was on the water and the Army was on the land. And yeah, they'd drop each other off and then go their separate ways. But during the global war on terror, we were all a closely integrated task force. And even our task force name, Siege of SOTF, Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force. Combined means international units. Joint means inter-service cooperation. So all of our task forces started with either C or J, combined and or J, joint. And again, in the Navy with the SEALs, you got, you know, plus or minus 2,000 SEALs. You know, a large portion of those are training and administrative. So you got 1,200 to 1,500 shooters at any one time in the SEAL teams, compared to USASOC, where you've got, you know, sometimes 40 to 50,000 between the Rangers, SF teams, the Night Stalkers, the SMUs. And, you know, we're a very small part of that pie. And of course, the two parts of Army SOF that are always forgotten about are psychological operations and civil affairs, which have very important missions as well. So as a tiny group of the broader ecosystem, we're always answering to the Army. And the answer that these two gentlemen had was, hey, we should start sending junior SEALs through Ranger School, SEAL officers specifically, through Ranger training, because as you well know, that is the crucible of small unit leadership for everyone in the Army. If you're going to carry a weapon and kill the enemy in the Army, then you're going to be a leader, a damn good chance you're going through Ranger School.
There's more to discuss about Tim Sheeby's life, and he's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Lenny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Guys, it's push-up time. I went in to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do. Well, twice a week anyway. Then take a break, but stay in the area. Tim and I will be right back.
This hour of Frontlines of Freedom is brought to you by HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net is an online resource and information center dedicated to the welfare of those who have sacrificed for the freedoms, ideals, and morals we Americans hold dear to our hearts. At HelpVet.net, find information on benefit-related issues from education, healthcare, military pay, retirement, VA loans, and resources on education, finance, legal, health and wellness, the military life, moving and housing, travel and entertainment, and much, much more. Visit HelpVet.net, HelpVet.net.
This is Colonel Lenny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with former Navy SEAL Tim Sheeby. Tim, you were wrapping up the way the teams from the different services work together. Give us a final thought on that now, because then I want to talk to you about what you did when you got out of the service.
Absolutely. So ultimately, what it came down to was making sure that us as the SEAL teams, who were the smallest constituency within SOCOM, were able to adapt our planning procedures, vocabulary, and operations so we could be compatible with our Army counterparts. And ultimately, I believe that we were very successful in that. On every deployment I did 5 deployments around the world. And every single deployment, I was either closely integrated or fully integrated with an Army unit of some kind, sometimes conventional, sometimes soft. So it was a very educational experience for me. And I know that the teams since my departure have continued to ensure that they're more ready than ever to work alongside our Army counterparts.
And that's what we got to be. And we really weren't that. We learned a little bit in World War II and a little bit in Korea. But I think our military today is much better off than we were before. Okay, Tim, once you got out, you needed to get a job. I know that was my focus. And civilians are really different than military folks. I mean, they don't stand up straight. Nobody in charge. They don't shine the backs of their belt buckles. How did you adjust into civilian life and what did you do?
So it was an interesting transition. Again, my wife was a Marine Corps officer. We met at the Naval Academy and I was a SEAL. So I'd gotten wounded and injured a number of times. So was medically taken off the operational roles and kind of had the decision to make was I was going to stay in the military as a desk guy or get out. And that just wasn't in my DNA. So we decided to get out. We didn't want to wait to do the 2-year med board and try to seek a retirement. It was just time to move on. And we decided to start a business around a capability I used overseas. And one of the best technical innovations of the global war on terror related to special operations is aerial surveillance. We'd always have an aircraft with specialized sensors over our head, providing real-time updates for the location and composition of the enemy using signals intelligence and imagery intelligence. So I saw how life-saving that capability could be. I used it a lot, having been a pilot growing up, you know, had a linkage with that. So I decided to start a company called Bridger Aerospace, which I still am the CEO of today, to focus on bringing that airborne intelligence capability in support of ground teams to more areas besides the military, border security, you know, law enforcement, and what our main business is now, wildfires. And, you know, wildfires, if you don't live in the Western U.S., may not be super familiar with them, but, you know, they're massive 10, 20, 100,000 acre incidents with hundreds, sometimes thousands of people on the ground fighting these fires with aircraft overhead. And I saw an opportunity to enhance their situational awareness so they could be safer and more effective on those fires. And today we created a few hundred jobs here in Montana from scratch. It was an all veteran founding team. We started in November 2014. We always focus on hiring veterans, not out of charity, but because, you know, we're lucky to have them because they know how to get things done. They know how to work hard. They know about loyalty and they know about mission. So we've created Bridger Aerospace. We're publicly listed on the NASDAQ today. We're the largest aerial firefighting company in the nation. And we've taken that close air support model that we really finely tuned in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we're trying to save lives here in America by doing the same mission over our wildfires.
Wow. That's got to be fulfilling because you not only get to continue the standing out and taking care of people thing, but you get to learn from your own mistakes and design something that works the way you think it should. That's got to be very fulfilling.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's the best job in the world. And I'm an active pilot of our water bombers. So in addition to running the company, I get to go out and fly my shifts and be a part of the team. And it's very fulfilling to be able to, obviously, we've all fought in the battlefield for America, but it's different when you're fighting here in America and protecting Americans with what you're doing. And, you know, looking down and seeing signs put on people's roofs as you fly over their houses at treetop level, you know, water bombing their backyard to protect their home, you know, thank you signs and, you know, we love you signs and all that. And it's great to see the appreciation that folks have because, you know, as you know, in our military, we're thousands of miles away and, you know, like your war, like my war, pretty soon people forgot we were even there and they stopped caring what we did. And they stopped caring that our friends were coming home in boxes because they didn't see it every day. But here, you know, when their communities are being burned over by wildfire, you know, it's real for them. And when they see our planes come through and those ground firefighters come in on the trucks, you know, it's a deep appreciation and it reminds them that there are still people out there that wear a uniform that put themselves in harm's way to protect them. And I think it's a very important thing for Americans to remember is whether it's military, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's first responders in the air or on the ground, most Americans enjoy their lifestyle because it is protected for them by others.
I couldn't say it better myself. I absolutely agree with that. I consider police and firefighters not our brothers in arms, but our brothers and sisters in valor, because they put their lives on the line every day. So yes, we need to salute them. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate that. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with former Navy SEAL Tim Sheeby. Tim, I know that you can't get serving our country out of your system. I've learned that from being around you. You want to serve our country again, and you've got some plans to do that. Talk to us about what you're focused on now.
So just recently, I announced for the U.S. Senate seat here in Montana. 2024 is our next election. 2024 is going to be a pivotal election for our nation across all three election lanes, House of Representatives, the Senate, and of course, the White House. I think we all know the White House these days, it's always a razor-thin fight. And to be honest, we don't know which way it's going to go, no matter how hard we work. House of Representatives, you know, can always be a bit of a guerrilla fight, too. And with all the redistricting, it's hard to know where that's going to go. The one race that we as Americans can really invest in, focus on, block and tackle our way to success is the Senate race in 2024. There are three Senate seats that are held by Democrat senators in deep red states. That's West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana. These seats are held by individuals who are deeply out of step with their electorate. Their voting record here in Montana, we have Senator John Tester, who is the chair of the VA committee, I might add. So right in line with our values and concerns. Hasn't served in the military, but does serve on the committee. And he is a very progressive senator in a state that's voted 20 points for Trump. He's up for re-election now for his fourth term after serving, you know, over 20 years in elected office between the state Senate and U.S. Senate. And it's time for him to retire. And it's time for him to retire because we have a government that's becoming unaccountable to its people. We have a government that is mortgaging our children's future with 135% debt to GDP ratio. We have a military that's reaching its lowest level of approval by the American people since the end of the Vietnam War. We're seeing weaponization of government agencies across the board. We're seeing bipartisan issues that let's drop the liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican label and just forget that and talk about what this country was founded on. The principles that this country was built upon and that made this country great are not our government, is not our economy even. It's the mind and spirit of free people and free Americans and what we've built. And what we saw over the last 3 years during COVID was the suppression of that, was the interference in the agency and the freedom of the human mind, body, and soul, especially during COVID. You can't leave your home. You can't have a job. You can't go to church. If you say something that we disagree with from the government narrative, you will be canceled. You'll be ridiculed. You'll be fired. You'll be banned from platforms. We are going to make sure that anybody who disagrees with the state's stated position on anything, from COVID to climate change to vaccines, is going to be publicly shamed and punished for that disagreement. And that's fundamentally un-American. And the government stepped in, and we had a 2.5-year test drive of complete government control of our nation. And that meant fiat currency pumped into our economy, which caused very, very predictable inflationary effects, which have harmed all Americans. We've seen an anti-energy agenda where we are actively trying to prohibit and constrict American energy production, which is disastrous for our economy and for our cost of living in our country. And we've seen foreign policy decisions like Afghanistan that were a disgrace to our nation. So regardless of party, everyone should agree that we need to balance our budget. We need to have a southern border that doesn't allow 70,000 Americans to be killed every year by Chinese fentanyl and opioids that are pouring across our border through criminal enterprises that are starting to control parts of the southwestern United States. We can agree that we want our children to go to school and not be indoctrinated by career bureaucrats, but taught how to think like Western education always has been. They need to have the freedom to discover what they believe and how they believe it. They don't need to be indoctrinated with those beliefs. And these are values that I believe cross the aisle and most Americans' minds, but unfortunately have become partisan issues in Washington, D.C. And in my opinion, it's time for a new generation of leaders to step up. Not the same old people that have been recycling through all these offices for the last 30 years causing these problems. Those are not going to be the people to solve this. We need a new generation of leaders. And I think our generation should be that. We fought our country's longest war. We had to get jobs and work through the Great Recession. We can step up now as our generation and say it's time for us to take over and have new solutions to solve these very, very serious problems. Because if we don't solve them in the next 10 years, we're not going to have a country to pass down to our children.
Well said, Tim. Tim, last question. How can listeners who may want to learn more or support you, how can they get in touch with you?
TimForMT.com, TimForMT.com. That'll tell you about me, my background, our campaign, why this race is so important here in Montana. And of course, it's an election campaign. Donate as well. Money's the fuel that makes these campaigns run. Unfortunately, that's the way the world works. So we're going to need a lot of help from a lot of people. So we're excited about the veteran community support for us so far. We've got a tremendous amount of support coming from the veteran community in Montana and nationally. And, I think veterans have shown time and again that we know how to work across the aisle to get things done. We can still be strong and strident in our conservative beliefs, but we also realize that at the end of the day, we're all Americans. And we have to work together to craft a better future for this nation.
Yes, sir. Tim, thank you. Thank you for your service to our nation in uniform and the way you're continuing to serve the nation now and your goal to serve. You're the kind of person that we need in Washington. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the time.
Final comment, beat Navy.
That's fair.
This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Air Force vet Ron Kraft about the 20th anniversary of a life-saving experience he had. Quentin Roberts will prep us for the Service Academy football season. And of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom Troops. It's time for pull-ups. Do 30 good ones. Grab some protein, rehydrate with water. And finally, put a big smile on your proud to be an American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.